Hello, I'm Karen Long, and you're listening to The Asterix, a production of the Anisfield Wolf Book Awards. An asterix is a reference mark indicating an omission. Today, we're figuring out some of the holes in our knowledge with author Ishmael Reed. Born 85 years ago in Chattanooga, Tennessee, Professor Reed won the 2022 Anisfield Wolf Lifetime Achievement Prize for his 6 decades as a poet, novelist, playwright, lyricist, cartoonist, musician, and founder of small presses and publications, doing it all with curiosity, bite, and a global reach. Celebrated as a teacher and for writing such groundbreaking novels as Mumbo Jumbo, Professor Reed was recognized in 1998 with a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant. Last year, he dropped a jazz solo album, The Hands of God, and was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. His most recent play, The Conductor, premiered in New York City this spring. Colson Whitehead once said, quote, "Some folks dream about being in Harlem during the 20s. I'm sad I didn't get to hang out in the late 60s Berkeley with Ishmael Reed," unquote. Reed lives and works in Oakland with Carla Blank, his wife and collaborator of more than 50 years. Their daughter, Tennessee, is a poet and managing editor of the magazine Conch. Welcome, Professor Reed. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Karen, for the nice introduction.
I'm excited to have you, of course, and I'm excited to hear some new work, a poem that was published just recently in the Alta Journal called "Yesterday's Newsreel Was Chasing Me." Do you mind reading that?
Well, I certainly will. I dreamt that yesterday's newsreel was chasing me. It had the head of a pop screen. It was on rolling skates and gaining on me. My feet hurt. I had shortness of breath. The white rooster they used as a logo was on the newsreel's shoulder, crowing its head off and angrily flapping its wings. And if that were not enough, they were playing that hot, scratchy, combative music, the newsreel's theme. Path was projecting images ahead of me. I almost ran into one. Bob Hope was telling jokes to the troops. Mussolini and his mistress, Clara Petacci, hanging upside down. FDR at Yalta. De Gaulle and the GIs entering Paris. School children hiding under their desks. Rita Hayworth, her hands on her knees, a pinup pasted on flying tigers. Her real name, Margarita Canesino. Hirohito was on horseback. Some uncouth baseball fan was handing Jackie Robinson a black cat. Robinson, who assaulted army officers for using the N-word, petted the cat. Buy Liberty Bonds. Rosie the Riveter, her sleeves rolled up. Just as the path was breathing down my neck, it passed me by. It was after somebody else. I wondered who, and I wondered why.
Thank you. Wow. In the intro to this, you mentioned that you saw a newsreel of Mussolini when you were 6 years old, and since his party's making a comeback in Italy, this poem came around. And it made me remember that at the end of Mumbo Jumbo, you describe time as a pendulum, not a river, more akin to what goes around comes around. Is that idea in this poem?
Well, I think so. And I think that it's also an instruction to the younger generation that World War II was more than the war that the Elvis fought in.
Mm-hmm.
See, 'cause yeah. There's a dearth of historical understanding, especially when it comes to American history. So that's one of the points of my work, is to remind the public and the readers of different aspects of American history, aspects that have been ignored. And I think this is that. Also, it uses a lot of pop images.
Mm-hmm.
But it's contrast to some serious topics. So I mix up the...
Yes, the tones. Pop, yes.
The historical weighty historical topics. And I think that always helps.
There is that beautifully cinematic quality. I feel like I'm watching a newsreel when you write Hirohito was on horseback. Someone Kuth baseball fan was handing Jackie Robinson a black cat. I'm right there with you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you're also asking your listener, your reader, to think about if anything has changed.
That's true. I think that the past is probably contemporary. And this is another idea that a number of writers deal with, including a writer that Carlo Blanc has had a lot to do to revive. He received an Annisfield Wolf Award, William Denby.
Yes, and you published one of his books.
I published two of his books. And as a result of Carlo Blanc and Melanie Shirazi, there's a renaissance going on of William Denby, but that's one of the big tributes that was paid to him, Annisfield Wolf, at a time when most readers and critics had forgotten about him.
Well, there's another thread that this poem brings me toward, which is one of the winners for 2023. The historian Matthew Delmont wrote this book called Half American about the more than 1 million Black people who served in the Second World War, to reclaim mm-hmm. some of that history. And the title, he explains on the very first page, comes from a 26-year-old at the time of Pearl Harbor's bombing, was working in a cafeteria in Wichita, Kansas. And he wrote the newspaper in Pittsburgh, the Pittsburgh Courier, which was then the largest yeah. mm-hmm. newspaper. And he asked, should I sacrifice my life to live half American? Will things be better for the next generation in the peace to follow? Would it be demanding too much to demand full citizenship rights in exchange for the sacrificing of my life? Is the kind of America I know worth defending?
Yes, well, that was a question facing the returning GIs
yes.
after World War II. You know, they were shortchanged the GI Bill. As a matter of fact, it was called the White GI Bill. And this meant, you know, millions in assets that were lost.
Yes. And we're living with the consequences of that racism baked in.
Absolutely. The deprivation of assets is a big part of American history that we ignore, and it's still going on. There's a Chris Matthews. He said that his father received a GI Bill, and that enabled him to send his kids to college.
Mm-hmm.
So, the million Blacks who fought in that war, who were deprived of the GI Bills, didn't have that opportunity, didn't have the opportunity to apply those assets to sending their children to higher education.
As I've watched and read your thoughts, Professor Reed, you seem to have a complicated relationship to money. One example might be that when you won, I love that you're both laughing, the MacArthur Grant, you distributed it in the name of art there in San Francisco and more broadly to support some plays. Talk about your relationship to money.
Well, I decided if I ever received a large award that many people would benefit. So first we, Carmen Moore and I did an opera called Gethsemane Park. Black theater is vanishing. And as a matter of fact, the audiences are dwindling, and because of the pandemic, it's gotten even worse. And I've written about the situation in Berkeley, where one of the oldest Black theaters, Black Repertory Group, is in trouble and mm-hmm. might have to shut down. And this is happening all over the country. So I spent thousands of dollars in Black theater efforts, both here and in New York. And Carla Blank has really been a big help in this because she's directed some of these plays and also been assistant director. So she's and, you know, as a matter of fact, co-producer. So I was commissioned by the San Francisco Opera Company to write a libretto for a very well-known musician, composer. And that didn't work out. I'll leave it at that. I think maybe the book was a little too wild for them because I took liberties with the, they asked me to write a book or a libretto based upon the arrest of Jesus Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane. So I took some liberties. As a matter of fact, Lazarus' mother complains about him coming back, but who's going to take care of him? She's sort of like a feminist. Who's going to take care of these men, you know, they brought? And then Calvin, the late Calvin Butts, Reverend Butts, he said, well, I had trouble with the book, but I like the music. But he said it gave him some thought, the idea that why would Lazarus want to return?
That's a question.
Mundane things, you know, when you've seen paradise, you know. So people, there are a lot of things that you don't necessarily find in the actual, you know, the traditional text. That wasn't the reason it was turned down. I think the composer couldn't come up with the music. Mm-hmm. And so the rights reverted to me, and I hired Carmen Moore, the great New York composer who was just admitted to the Academy, the American Academy. And he came up with an excellent score within 3 months. We call it a gospel because we hired both gospel singers and opera singers. That's who were the divas. I mean, you know, the gospel singers are hard to get. And this thing was a very popular, what I call a populist people's opera. We hired people who were really off the street, some were untrained. And it premiered in Berkeley, the Berkeley Black Rep. And then it traveled to New York. It played in New York and also San Francisco. We're trying to get funding to give it the kind of treatment it deserves. But I financed that. And I've been financing Black theater since the MacArthur Award. I couldn't do it without Carla. Carla's doing a new play. Well, you mentioned the play, The Conductor.
Right.
The Conductor's returning this month at the Theater for the New City in New York on First Avenue. And she's going to direct that play and undergoing rehearsals by Zoom so far.
What happens in a play that doesn't happen in a novel for you?
Theater, I've found to probably be one of the most difficult of the arts because there's so many variables. And we're experiencing that now. Mm. For example, some of the actors are in other plays, and we have to sort of like adjust their time and rehearsals to that. Just unpredictable things happen. I've been writing these novels. I think I'll take a little vacation and write some plays. And she said, well, you don't know what you're getting into. So my first play, the leading lady collapsed on stage and had to be rushed to the hospital.
No bueno.
And then The director was arrested for possession of guns and narcotics. What happened was these guys are from Texas and Louisiana, so they said they insisted upon using real guns. And so the director got into an altercation with a policeman. They found the guns, and then he had the stage money. And the police said, well, this stage money is just so you can deceive another. So I mean, it was a mess, that first play. So I really learned since then that theater is difficult. It's very difficult.
What was that first play?
It was called Hubba City, and it was about the crack epidemic in Oakland.
So you have a deep relationship with Oakland. I don't get a sense you would move off your street. Is that correct?
Well, I think that's probably correct. Although this is not the same neighborhood it was, say, 10 years ago, because it's been regentrified. Before that, it was maybe 98% Black, this neighborhood was. I think at first we had a difficult time blending in, because I think they figured we were just some, you know, upper bohemians or something like that. But when the crack epidemic broke out, you know, our family took the leadership in, you know, stabilizing the neighborhood mm-hmm. and discouraging this kind of behavior. And as a matter of fact, my daughter and I, Tennessee, we got one of the crack houses torn down. It took us 2 years.
Good on you.
But I have a photo. I wrote about the neighborhood in two installments in Alta Magazine, which is produced by Willie Hearst III. And that's where the poem appeared yesterday. Yes. And I talk about the neighborhood in those two articles.
As I think about your creative collaboration, its longevity, its beauty, I just want to ask the human question of what makes a good marriage?
Well, I think we're both artists, I think, to begin with. And we've been collaborating since around 1965. We did a show called Black, which was the idea of the late Aldo Tambellini, the great Italian artist. And that was at the Bridge Theater on St. Mark's Place. And we've been in collaboration since. And Carla's background comes in handy. Of course, she's a master theater of arts. As a matter of fact, she was partly responsible for the rise of Pakistani theater.
Hmm.
There was a student in my class named Wajahat Ali.
Yes.
And he disappeared for 3 weeks because of the 9/11.
Ah.
When he returned, he thought I was going to suspend him from the class. I said, no, I don't want you to do short stories. I want you to respond to the propaganda that's coming from the corporate media by writing a play. And I told him he should write a play about a family. And I gave him Lorraine Hansberry's Raising a Son, Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman, and that great play by Eugene O'Neill, Long Day's Journey Into Night. I said, these are family situations, and you should write about a Pakistani-American family living in the neighborhood you guys live. So he came up with the Domestic Crusaders. He wrote 20 pages. He thought that was the end. So after he heard it, I said, we're not finished with you. I said, I want you to, you know, write a full length play. And he said, well, I don't know anything about writing a whole play. So I gave him, I put him under the tutelage of Carla, and they worked, was it 2 years, Carla?
Yeah.
They worked on the play for 2 years.
2003 to 2005.
They worked on the play, and it started out at a restaurant in Fremont, California, where, what was the deal? You buy a meal and you get to see.
The only way they could convince people to come was to
400 people showed up. 400 people was never seen the theater or a play before. So I traveled from there to the Berkeley Rep, to New York, and finally at the Kennedy Center. And since then, it's been performed in London and, was it Toronto?
Yeah, Lincoln Center.
Center.
Yeah, the last performance that I was involved in was 2011, but it was published by McSweeney's, and I think it's been done a lot in college campuses since.
Yes, yes. Well, that doesn't satisfy my curiosity about how a marriage is made.
Well, I think the collaboration is very important. So Carla, you know, is classically trained violinist, so she came in handy when we did two albums.
Mm-hmm.
I got a cancer diagnosis in 2005 or something like that. And I said, before I check out of here, I want to play bebop. And so we put out a CD called For All We Know. It's still being circulated and reviewed. And we were lucky to get David Murray and like some of the top musicians. And Carla played violin. And then I started studying jazz piano at the age of 60.
Right.
Susan Masarello at first, and then the great Mary Watkins second. She's like a drill sergeant. I said, oh no, is that woman coming today? No, I mean, she's barking orders at me. And
that's not what would make a good marriage.
Mary Watkins is very good. But I mean, I learned a lot from Mary. And so I was able to play around the world, you know, Budapest, yes. Lagos, all kind of places. And so we put that album up, For All We Know. And then Grace Wales Bonner flew me to London to play behind her fashion show. And that's where the name Hands of Grace comes from.
Mm.
The CD that the reading group produced, and Carla's on that one too. And one of the big hits of that CD is the elegy for Lucille Clifton, who was a friend of mine in Buffalo, New York.
Yes.
Producer Langston Hughes.
Yes.
First, publication. You know, they just dedicated a monument to her downtown Buffalo.
Yes, so glad. We need more monuments like that.
And now we'll pause for a short break. The Asterix is a project of the Cleveland Foundation to bring more readers and listeners into conversation with the best writers in English, in this case, recipients of the Annisfield Wolf Book Award. We'll now return to the conversation.
So I'm going to think just alongside you that the collaboration, as you say, is key. The chemistry has to be there. But also I was thinking about something that happened when you were in Cleveland, Professor Reed, when you invited the young poet from the ceremony to publish her poem in your magazine. And of all the years we've had a young poet, she's been received, or he's been received, as someone talented and becoming. But you greeted Kite Lynn as someone who could be received as a poet now. It was a difference, and it was a solemnity and a beauty in seeing her that I haven't observed in other circumstances. And as I read about your life, so many people have been in your orbit and thrived. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I just got a note from Bryn Saito, who was teaching at a college here in California. And she told me, very, very nice note. I published her when she was an undergraduate.
Wow.
And then we put her, Carl and I put her in From Totals to Hip Hop, an anthology of poets. And Helen Vindler noticed her poem.
Huh.
And we printed her, and the rest is history. So she's had about two or three books of poetry out, and was featured in Vogue magazine. And so when I became a member of the faculty at the University of California, Berkeley, I was there. I came as an anthologist and as an editor, and I was looking for talent. And so a number of us, people who are well-known now, we first published when they were students, like Mona Simpson.
Yes.
We published her, and she's now a publisher of the Paris Review.
Yes, she is.
And Terry McMillan, we published her when she was a student. So there are a number of major writers whom we published either through the student anthologies that we did every class, or our magazines, Yard, Bird, Quilt, the magazines that the late Al Young and I used to edit. Now, I don't know whether I told you this, but Viet, our colleague, who wrote The Sympathizer.
Yes.
Gave us a real thumbs up with that poem. I think you should tell her that.
I will tell her that.
Pulitzer Prize winner.
Yes.
Love
and so
poem.
You had the vehicle and you had the intentionality. Is there something else in the formula that allows
us? When I arrived in New York in my early 20s, I really thought I was all that. You know, people had told me, well, you know, when I became an anthologist, it occurred to me that talent was common.
Hmm.
It's a very humbling situation. After you read maybe 1,000 or so manuscripts or more than that, you'll find that, I mean, the whole idea of who becomes a diva or a divos is arbitrary.
Yeah.
That there's a lot of talent out there, which makes you, you know, come down a few notches to know that. I think some of those who've been anointed as tokens maybe not don't realize that, but if they did an anthology. And, you know, it came to a point where some of the professors couldn't distinguish between a student poem and a poem written by a well-canonized poet. I went to the National Council of Teachers of English, and I read a poem by a student, and I read a poem by a canonized poet. I asked which one was which. 50% said the canonized poet was a student. It was a canonized poet. So it's all very arbitrary. So I think when you learn that, you realize that you're very lucky to get whatever, you know, recognition you can get in your lifetime, which William Denby did not receive.
Right.
I mean, in the notes about him, they keep referring to the Annisfield Wolf Awards as maybe his only recognition at the time. And he died without getting his final novel published. We published, Carla and Melanie published that book. We all published that book. But he ran into trouble with Love Story Black. And his great work, The Catacombs, is out of print. Mm. But because of their efforts, there's a sort of renewed interest in his work. There was a conference in Italy, in Rome, where, you know, people came from different parts of the world to talk about Denby. So we're on a deadline. Yes. I'm finishing a book. That deadline is Monday, as a matter of fact, about Denby.
Good. That is good for our listeners to know. So just 3 years ago, UC Berkeley named you the Emeritus Professor of the Year, and Jeffrey Knapp called you, quote, enormously charismatic and effective as a teacher. What makes an effective teacher? What's happening in the classroom that we have endless conversations about your students?
Well, I think Mona Simpson said that she talked about being in my class. She said everybody improved. Mm. And I think when you do it, as long as I have been writing since, high school, even if you start out dumb, you know a few things. So I'm able to recognize the strengths and weaknesses of different writers. And some of them are very serious. And as I was talking about Brienne Saito, who wrote this marvelous poem that Helen Vinder picked up. So you never know who's watching you.
Mm-hmm. You at one point said, quote, "I think I have a pugnacious style. My style is not pretty. I don't use words like amber or opaque," unquote. And I'm not buying that, because even in Mumbo Jumbo, you're using panache and picaresque. What are you trying to tell us?
Well, we try to be like tough guys, you know, because if you come from certain ethnic groups, and this is not just Black, but others, people who work with their hands, you know, it's very suspicious when you see a guy, you know, reading poetry and stuff like that. So I think we overdid it. And we all influenced by Malcolm X and Chester Hines, because that was a generation where they really said what was on their minds. Mm-hmm. Chester Hines said, who lives in this house, he lived here one summer, 1981. He said, to say the unsayable and to think the unthinkable. And so that's why my work looks provocative. And we try to write about contemporary events. As a matter of fact, this new play, Carl and I are calling it a living newspaper. Mm-hmm. We're reviving this form that was used by the WPA in the 1930s.
Yes.
And shut down by the conservatives. It addressed the current events of the day. For example, I keep changing the script to align with what's happening in the news. And so, for example, I've deleted some things from the last version and added some updates, like what happened at Harvard University. Mm-hmm. Affirmative action, was, although the Chinese students who testified at the hearing said they were perfectly satisfied with affirmative action, and they weren't against it. But people with money, certain foundations, put up stooges or pawns, which the Asian American writers were quite aware of.
Right. And so
after the decision came down, I was expecting the offended Chinese American students to take them. No, what happened was they got Ed Bloom.
Yes, you wrote about that recently.
Yeah, I said, the fifth white man to play Charlie Chan. But anyway, I was able to get the views of Chinese American scholars. First, I published it in El País. Sometimes my op-eds are not welcome here, so I get them published in Haaretz or El País,
right.
Liberation in Paris. And so I was able to quote Jeff Chang, who wrote a book called Who We Be.
Yes.
Writes about hip-hop. And he had a totally different viewpoint than Ed Blum had about it. He said that it was a put up job and that, you know, Asian Americans didn't have much input on what happened with that decision. As a matter of fact, when they had the hearings, the Chinese students who were invited to the hearings supported affirmative action.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a put up job. It's like this anti-woke hysteria and this whole thing that's happening across the country. And that's what The Conductor is about. And so Carl and I continue to do research on some of the hidden contributors to this anti-woke hysteria. And they turn out to be, you know, high-tech billionaires and people like
right.
that. That's what happened in San Francisco. You had right-wing high-tech billionaires behind the recall. Although if you look at the New York Times, you would think that San Francisco was like the summer of love. That it's like a big old Haight-Ashbury. You know what I mean? It's so dated. I mean, you know, Black people had to leave San Francisco because of the high rents.
Right. As you and Carla research, Professor Reed, one question that keeps recurring to me is, you create a lot of media and information, but what sources do you trust? You are so skeptical of so much of the narrative out there. So where do you research and how do you know to trust it?
Well, you know, I've had my first work in a political. I trust political. As a matter of fact, the senior editor there is a former student of mine we published. So the students pay you back. Teresa Wills. Teresa Wills has a position at Politico, and I published her when she was at Dartmouth as anthology. And so I went to this information so available that I'm surprised that, you know, more of the pundits and the people who hired opinion makers don't use it. I went to the Harvard Crimson, which reveal the money behind the affirmative action thing at Harvard. And they said it was, you know, former Clarence Thomas clerks went on it. And
right. Student journalism is having a moment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the information is out there. It's not hard to find.
One of the things I love is your poem that you wrote February 22nd, 1973. The author reflects on his 35th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And it fits in our conversation because it has to do, it's funny, but it also is asking us to think about the attitude we carry in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And you're talking to the number 35 that you have reached,
mm-hmm.
and you write, 35, make me Tennessee mean, Cobra mean, Cuckoo mean, Injun mean, Dracula mean, Beethoven brows mean, Miles Davis mean, don't offer assistance when quicksand is tugging some poor dope under mean, pawnbroker mean, Pharaoh mean. That's it, 35. Make me Pharaoh mean as it can be, mean as the Dickens, meaner than mean. And 35, don't let me trust anybody over Reed, but just in case, put a tail on that Negro too.
That's a real beauty of a paranoid poem. you know, when I read that poem, I was 35. A woman was 65. She said, where do you get 65?
So answer her question now that you're 85.
Well, you know,
what do you see?
I think that poem came about as a result of trying to flatter someone's talents. Mm-hmm. And it took me a long time to learn that people just want to remain miserable and are really against their development and their potential. That's human nature. But that was an important lesson for me to learn, that you can't coach people into goodness or greatness or you know, to become excellent. You cannot coach people into that because a lot of people are not farsighted and are really against themselves. Mm. So that was very important. So that was a reaction. Let me laugh my head off with Moby Dick as we
yes.
saw the suckers who went down with the Pequot. That's my favorite line.
It's another great line in that poem. Recommend it to everyone. What books are you recommending to people?
Well, I read mostly nonfiction. I'm reading mostly nonfiction. I read a lot of history, I think. Right now, I'm finishing this book about William Denby. So that led me to read about the Cherokee Nation and what happens when you try to acculturate or assimilate or try to play by the rules. You know, they learned English and they became Christians and gave up their culture and religion. And what happened as we, you know, they were deported, they were massacred, their lands were stolen. So those are that's one of the current books I'm reading. I also wrote the introduction to the new Library of America's Johnny Williams, The Man Who Cried I Am.
Mm-hmm.
I've been reading about, you know, World War II and the situation of the Buffalo soldiers, the black soldiers in Italy. And matter of fact, this poem is a result of that reading. Yesterday's newsreel was chasing me.
Good to know.
Whole campaign there in Italy. Both of us are looking at some of the actors in this, you know, movement to, you know, change the American curriculum and incorporating that in the play. So that's a lot of reading because people don't realize that this is a nationwide effort.
Mm-hmm.
To sort of like change the curriculum and to suppress Latino, Black, and Asian American studies. And, you know, we haven't even begun to look at the treatment of the Chinese, for example, in California. That's a horrible story, but I guess they have enough on their hands with us. They see us as the ringleaders. I mean, we're really the mischief makers of America, according to some of the columnists and some of the commentary, and that, you know, what happened at Harvard will diminish the enrollment of both Latino
countries, mm-hmm.
this ethnic group, and Blacks, but they single Blacks out, you know, because we're the ones who are putting everybody else up to mischief. So, for example, with the Black Arts Movement, many different ethnic groups, members of those ethnic groups began writing about their own traditions and cultures. And they will tell you that. Native Americans, Asian Americans, Latinos will tell you that they got their start by reading Black arts stuff. That was a revolt against the Anglo studies. And we were very much influenced by the Irish.
Yes, you like Yeats
very much
bringing the Celtic bits back.
Yeah, we're very much influenced by, I mean, if you look at the curriculum in the 1950s when I went to a university, you see Greece and Rome, then all of a sudden you got these strange gods. You know, so who are these? And then you found out there was something called a Celtic revival, which was the assertion of the Irish to be inspired by their folklore and their mythologies instead of mimicking the imperialists, or those, I guess the British were the imperialists at the time. And so that inspired me in the university. I said, these guys were trying to assert their own culture and ethnicity. I'm doing a thing with Zora Neale Hurston. I'm reading Dust Tracks on the Road.
Yes, that's an Anisfield Wolf winning book.
Well, I received the North Star Award this year from the Hurston Wright.
Wonderful.
And there's ceremonies in Washington in October. So in connection with that, I've been reading Zora Neale Hurston again. And she did a remarkable thing. She learned, her education was Eurocentric, and she really excelled at that. But she used that to restore or to study Black folklore.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, she was a preservationist.
Yes.
And that is, I think that's what we've been doing with Before Columbus Foundation, which was inspired by my relationship with Carla Blank, because when I met Carla, she was in contact with different groups. Like, you want to talk about that, Carla? The Indians that were in your household?
Yeah, well, I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and right near what is now called Carnegie Mellon University. And after independence, there was, I think it was must have been a federally supported program to bring students to study the sciences. And our home became, because my mother's best friend was married to an Indian chemist who was leader of the Indian American community in Pittsburgh, our home became a center where they just hung out and cooked on their weekends. And because we were four little girls and they were missing their children at home, they took us under their wing. And then when I started my professional career, I did a long collaboration with a Japanese dancer, Suzushi Hanayagi. And so I was taken in under their wing. I had just graduated college, and her circle of Japanese artists became friends of mine. So those were two particularly strong international connections that I had that at the time when Ishmael and I started hanging out together.
Yeah, so I was introduced to the Japanese American and Indian community through Carl, and then we added people. And before Columbus Foundation, which I began in 1976, it's sort of like a result of that collaboration.
Yes.
And now we, the Before Columbus Foundation, we have two MacArthur winners, a Pulitzer Prize winner, winner of the Booker Prize, and two former poet laureates of the United States as directors.
Let's go.
We do the American Book Awards each year.
Right.
The Washington Post calls the American Book Awards the American League to the National Book Awards National League. So
here we are. What do you think about Cornel West running for president?
I think it's a bad idea. I don't know. I think Cornell's ego needs a vacation because he's very seductive and charismatic. And what I say about Cornell is that he quotes theologians who use bigger words than Jesus. I mean, Jesus will say something like, I am the least of these. And he quotes these interpreters. Very difficult to decipher what they're driving at. But a re-election of Trump would set us back 100 years. And I saw a poll in Michigan where if Cornell ran, he'd get 3% and Michigan would go to Trump. So I don't know what's happening with the East Coast Black intelligentsia. I mean, they gave us critical race theory if that wasn't bad enough. It's a graduate school thing. But now I think a lot of them are, what I say, are dozing off at the dinner party and asleep at the brunch because they do not realize the threat to Cornel West is making and helping. And then I saw him, I don't know what's going on. I saw him defend Putin. Mm. I mean, Putin, you know, who's poisoning his adversaries and the stuff he's doing in Ukraine is just, you know, horrible genocide. And then he's saying, well, you know, NATO's behind the whole line, you know, the NATO's behind the whole thing. And NATO is, it's NATO's fault and all this kind of stuff. So I don't know what's going on at Cornell, but I see a deafening silence from the Black intelligentsia. And I just don't know the reason for that. But I wish that he would, you know, just continue the kind of scholarship that he does, you know, quoting these hard to read and hard to understand theologians.
Well, it loops us back to yesterday's newsreel was chasing me because that's the fire he's playing with, perhaps.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The newsreel will catch up with you.
Well, this has been really joyful, and you've been so generous, and it's good to see your faces. I long to see them unpixelated, and I think that we might have a chance by and by, I hope.
Oh, thank you, Karen.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Be well.
The Asterix is brought to you by the Cleveland Foundation. The executive producer is Alan Ashby, with help from producer Tara Pringle Jefferson. Cleveland Public School students, working with the Cleveland Classical Guitar Society, wrote and performed our original score. I'm Karen Long, manager of the prizes. Visit annisfield-wolf.org to learn more on the history of the award, about previous winners, and upcoming events. And thank you for listening.